from spooky legends past, down through generations, to haunted locations that hold a ghostly past. Come one, come all, come finders and seekers, hear the creepy side of Nipa.
Welcome to the creepy side of Nipa. I am Dan Kozlowski.
And I'm Nora Herchick.
Before we get into today's episode, I'd like to just remind you of a couple things we have going on. First, we have the Creepy Side of Nipa Halloween quiz that's available to you at WNEP.com/contest. What better way to test your knowledge of the creepy side of Nipa and Halloween and win some great prizes along the way? And Nora, what else do we have?
We also have a map. It's the Creepy Side of Nipa map. You can check that out on our Facebook page, which is WNEP's Creepy Side of Nipa. If you haven't, make sure that you like our Facebook page for any updates. But the map is really cool. You can go on there and you can see all of the different locations that we have featured on all of the episodes so far of the Creepy Side of Nipa, if you guys wanted to go and check out some of these places for yourself.
We have a really interesting guest on today's episode, Jeffrey Frazier, who wrote a book series titled Pennsylvania Fireside Tales. Jeff, welcome to the show tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Jeff, I came across your books online. How did you get started with this idea of covering the creepier side, the tales of Pennsylvania?
Yeah, well, it all started with homesickness. I graduated from Penn State and ended up in New Jersey and had sort of a Tom Sawyer boyhood running the mountains here in central Pennsylvania. I grew up in Centre County. And then I ran across books written by an early collector of Pennsylvania mountain folk tales and legends, and I fell in love with them. And then I decided I could do it on my own, and it really snowballed from there. So as a result of that, I've been doing this for 50 years, and I've published a series of books I call Pennsylvania Fireside Tales. And in those books, I've classified my stories into four types. There are the early hunting episodes, and there are packs of wolves and mountain lions in the mountains, the stories about how people hunted them, sometimes were hunted by them, men and women alike. Then you have your Indian-based episode, a lot of legends that the Indians had about different places in Pennsylvania, and also family world histories about the Indian Wars in Pennsylvania. And then there's a catch-all category, stories of lost treasure, hidden gold, enormous snakes, other exaggerated animals, and so forth. Then also the ghost, witch, and supernatural stories. It all sounds like tall tales to people. So in my books, I try to act like an investigative reporter and explore the history and put them in a historical context, and that includes the ghost stories. And at this time of year, the month of October, the month of Halloween, or the witching month, people like to hear stories of ghosts, witches, and other kind of supernatural things, and their minds turn to maybe there just might still be things that hide in the dark mists and nighttime shadows, secretly watching dark clouds glide over the face of an orange harvest moon, you know, that sort of thing.
So sure.
What I'd like to do is, you mentioned about telling some of the stories from your viewing area, and so I'd like to share some of the stories I've collected in your viewing area, starting with a couple from that wonderful place called Ricketts Glen State Park. That spans Luzerne, Sullivan, and Columbia counties. And its most prominent feature is the Glen's natural area with its numerous waterfalls. It's a spectacular tourist attraction. People just love walking down the trail and above Kitchen Creek and looking down into that gloomy ravine. Every time I do that, and I walk down that slippery trail, there's a lot of mist through that little ravine, through that hollow there, and dark, tall trees that grow up on both sides of the creek and on one side or the other side of the trail. So it gives you a very gloomy, misty appearance, and thoughts of the Black Forest of Germany and the Brothers Grimm, who collected the legends and folk tales from that area back in the mid-1800s, always come to my mind, you know, so that as I think about that, I think to myself, maybe a gnome or a troll or the Wicked Witch of Hansel and Gretel fame might be popping out here any second. But there are no ghosts there in the Glen that I'm aware of, but there are several in Ricketts Glen State Park that are associated with nearby areas, and I'd like to tell you the tales of some of those ghost episodes.
Sure, I know Ricketts Glen State Park is a pretty popular park around here, and I always known it for its beauty, but never really heard much of the creepy side. How about you, Nora?
No, I've definitely never heard any of the creepy parts of it, but I've definitely hiked around up there a little bit, so I'm interested to know if any of these places are places that I've hiked.
Oh, yeah, I think you'll find this interesting because there's some really neat places there that have these ghost tales associated with them. And the first tale I'm going to talk about, I've titled, it's in my latest book. I've published a book called Pennsylvania Fireside Ghost Tales. People like my ghost tales and my other books, my Pennsylvania Fireside Tales books, said you ought to write a book just in ghost tales. But I was never too keen about that, not wanting to be labeled a ghost hunter. But my wife and I started to stay at different state parks and visit state parks, including Ricketts Glen. And I'm getting these firsthand ghost experiences from the employees at these places. So I'm thinking, you know, if I combine ghost tales and the historic places in Pennsylvania, including state parks, it could be a good book. And it's proved to be so. And one of the stories in that book, I've titled The Ghost Tree. And it occurs in Ricketts Glen State Park, an area there. But let me give you a little bit of background on Ricketts Glen State Park first. The Ricketts Glen is named for R.B. Ricketts. He was a soldier in the Civil War, and after the war ended, he bought 80,000 acres of timberland up there around Ricketts Glen and started a lumbering operation. But he wasn't the only one. There were other lumbering operations in that area as well. But that created a lot of employment, a lot of jobs for locals.
Right.
And as a result, there were a lot of towns, little towns that grew up here, including a town called Ricketts, named after R.B. Ricketts. And at that time, lumber companies weren't too concerned about the safety of their employees. And the lumbering industry today has a lot of injuries associated with it. It's a dangerous profession. But back then, it was even more so because, as I say, companies weren't too keen about worrying about the safety of their employees. The bottom line was the main thing. Anyway, historical record confirms that there were many injuries of workers in the lumbering camps back in the time of R.B. Ricketts. And the story is that there was one brother who worked for the Ricketts Lumber Company, and his younger brother wanted to be a lumberman in the worst kind of way. And so he finally got a job with the lumber company, but his older brother felt a little bit obligated. He wanted to take him under his wing and make sure he stayed safe and learned the ropes in the right way. So the story is that one day, the two brothers were cutting down a massive tree, and the older brother crawled up in the tree and was sawing off a really heavy limb. And the younger brother, being new in the job or maybe having his mind elsewhere, wasn't aware of what his older brother was doing. He was standing under the tree, and when that limb broke off and fell, it fell on the younger brother and crushed him like an eggshell. And the story goes that when the older brother saw what happened and crawled down the tree and knelt down beside his dead brother, his screams and moans could be heard from in nearby lumber camps. And eventually the lumber industry died off there, the lumber tracks eventually being depleted.
Mm-hmm.
And the last tract of lumber was cut off there on Cherry Ridge in 1913. And the tree that the brothers had been working on had since been cut down and lumbered off and carted away. But apparently somebody, at one point in time, after the last tract of timber was cut off, planted a tree in memoriam to the younger brother who was killed in that spot, planted a tree there. An interesting thing about that tree is that it grew to full height, but it never bore any leaves, fruit, or nuts of any kind. And it stands there yet today. And the interesting thing about it is it's white as a ghost and silent as death. And it's pure white, as though it's covered by a killing frost. And to this day, there are those who claim to have heard moans, sighs, and screams at this very same spot. And if you go to this spot, you also find that there are the foundation and some of the remaining walls of the lower story of the old pump house that can still be seen nearby today. In fact, it stands above where the old ghost tree stands. It's a very unique tree. You'd be able to spot it quite easily.
Yeah, very interesting. And so the tree grew to full length, full height, I would say, and just no leaves or no sign of life on it?
Not at all. It's just bare branches, but it's white, pure white. And
how would you get to the tree if you like wanted to go and see it?
Well, if you go into what was once the village of Ricketts, it's the site of the ghost town of Ricketts now, but you walk around there, and I can't tell you exactly how to get there very easily, but you'll find a stone foundation, and it's got some walls still standing. It was the old pump house. And if you face the pump house and look down onto the field below it, you'll see this white tree. It's very tall and very distinctive. So if you get to the pump house, and if you look, if you ask the park rangers, they can direct you to that. That's how I got a good picture of it. And Dan, I did send you a picture of that tree, by the way.
Yep, we will post the pictures on WNEP's Creepy Side of NEPA Facebook page, and that way all the listeners could go and take a look at the pictures that you're speaking about today.
Great, great. I think that'll make it more interesting for them. I'm glad that they're going to use it.
Sure.
Okay, so there's another tale, ghost tale, associated with Ricketts Glen, and this involves numerous ghosts. Another tourist attraction at Ricketts Glen is the large lake known today as Lake Jean. And this place is where my second tale goes. It's a tale I titled in my Pennsylvania Fireside Ghost Tales book, A Watery Grave. And the old timers in this area told of several other resident ghosts of the glens that make their home at the tip of a small peninsula which extends out into the lake near the visitor center. And back in the mid-1800s, the lake was known as the Mud Pond. It wasn't known as Lake Jean in those days. And at that time, the only residents in that area were a family named Getz. And they had a one-room log cabin that sat on the peninsula, right, which is now part of the outer camping loop today. And they had only one child, and he was the apple of their eye. He was just their only son, and of course, they delighted in spoiling him. And he was 9 years old when this happened, and they could deny him nothing. And one Christmas time, he told them he really wanted a pair of silver skates. He wanted to ice skate on the lake. And so they gave in, and they managed to buy him a pair of silver skates. But they told him on Christmas Eve, when they gave him the skates, that the lake had not frozen over thick enough that he could try to skate on it, that
right.
It was too dangerous. But, of course, being 9 years old, some advice like that goes in one ear out the other. And, of course, visions of his new skates and the appeal of using them on the lake proved to be too great. And early the next morning, he went down, got the skates, and went out on the lake, started to skate around on it in circles. And he skated in circles. He got closer and closer to the center of the lake where the ice was the thinnest. And at one point, he broke through the ice. And so his screams alerted his parents, who by that time were awake, and they immediately rushed out to the lake and saw him struggling in the water in the middle of the lake. And in their efforts to rescue him, they too were broke through the ice and were pulled down into the cool depths of the water, and all three of them drowned in the lake.
Okay.
So the whole family drowned in the lake?
Yes, the mother, the father, and the little nine-year-old boy.
What a tragedy.
Yeah, but then their log cabin stood deserted for a number of months before people realized, because there weren't too many neighbors that were around at that time,
right,
who passed through that area. They realized that the family wasn't there, and they began to wonder why. And then finally they realized what had happened. I guess they could see some evidence that the lake had holes in it or whatever. But anyway, they realized that the people had drowned in the lake. So after that, they shunned the cabin. They avoided it for fear that it was haunted, the spirits of the people that had drowned there. But eventually, after decades passed, fishermen and huntermen started to use it as a shelter on their hunting and fishing expeditions in the area. It was still fairly sturdy and provided some shelter from the elements. But then they began to report strange happenings when they billeted there, and also hearing strange foreign voices in the outside at night. And all kinds of strange things were happening. And so they eventually avoided the place as well. And even today, inexplicable things are said to happen here or on the lake nearby. Fishermen and hunters still come here. And fishermen sometimes report, it is said, that when they're in their boats out in the lake, and that sometimes they'll spot, emanating from the middle of the lake, the center of the lake, a yellow glow from under the waters of the lake, and it just stays there. But when they row their boats out and have enough curiosity and enough nerve to explore, they report that the glowing light just mysteriously disappears. Others have said, however, that when they get to that center section and look down into the waters, they will see three faces staring up at them from under the water. Three mournful, desolate, dead-like faces.
Wow, that's creepy.
So, Yeah.
Is the cabin still up? Like, is there any part of the cabin that still can be seen, or is that just long gone?
No, that's long gone. It's the outer camping loop now. That's where people can rent lots to pitch their tents, support their trailers to stay overnight. So, yeah, it's all cleared off now.
So even though the cabin's not there, you could basically camp right where the cabin had been.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly so. Yes, right. And so, you know, people have seen this, and I've never talked to anybody dead, but that's the legend. And so they say that proves that this is the watery Christmas Eve grave of the family who once lived there.
Very interesting story.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'd want to go camping there.
yeah.
I don't know if I'm brave enough.
Definitely sounds like it could be an interesting night.
Yes, it would be. I have another story. It's not a ghost story. I know your viewers probably want to hear ghost stories, but as I said, Halloween is a time of ghost witches and other supernatural tales. And mm-hmm. I want to share with you one of the tales, one of the most unusual and fantastic supernatural stories I ever collected. And, of course, some of the things that go bump in the night are not just ghosts and vampires, but also werewolves. If you read any of the literature of these kinds of stories. And werewolves certainly aren't creatures anybody believes in today. But just 200 years ago, there was a story that occurred in Northumberland County, which I've titled in my Pennsylvania Fireside, in my volume 7 of my Pennsylvania Fireside Tales books. I call it A Werewolf of Lion Mountain. As I say, this tale took place in Northumberland County, and I heard it from one of the last Pennsylvania Dutch speaking gentlemen in the county, if not the state. He was 96 years old at the time, and he was a former justice of the peace of Northumberland County. And the story was so fantastic and so unusual and so intriguing that I just had to explore the place, the sites where this story supposedly took place. So one fine April day in 2013, it was one of the finest early spring days you can imagine. April day in 2013, my wife drove into what's called the Schwaben Creek Valley there in Northumberland County.
Okay.
It's called S-C-H-W-A-B-E-N. And we were looking for some evidence of the elements of the story that was told to me about a werewolf. And I was just totally besotted by the place. It was one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. You looked in all directions. You could see fields of green and gold, herds of black and white cattle in the fields, you know, red barns, huge towering farmhouses of limestone, white and gray. And there were dark blue mountains in all directions as you looked on the horizon. And also a deep blue sky with fluffy white clouds floating in there. Perfect day, just perfect, just ideal. But I drove up and down that valley probably half a dozen times. And I was struck by one thing that was missing. And that thing was flocks of sheep. I did not see flocks of sheep anywhere. Did see a sign at the end of one dirt farm lane leading up to a farm at the edge of Lion Mountain. And the name of that sign was Sheep Lane. So I knew that at one time somebody must have raised sheep in that area.
Yeah.
But since there wasn't any there yet at that time, I began to wonder if some elements of the old tale that the 96-year-old Parson Snyder told me, that was the gentleman's name that told me the tale, former Justice of the Peace of Northumberland County, began to wonder if some of the elements of the tale might be true after all. And the story begins with a family named Paul, that's P-A-U-L, who were one of the first families to settle in the Schwaben Creek Valley. And that Schwaben Creek Valley, by the way, takes its name from Schwabia over in Germany. And the original settlers in the Schwaben Creek Valley were predominantly German and from Germany and from the Schwabia area in Germany. So they named their valley Schwaben Creek Valley. But the family named Paul were one of the first families to settle in that area. And they had a small daughter. Not sure what her age was at the time, but she was old enough to take on some responsibility every day. The responsibility was to take the sheep out of their sheep pen and usher them out into a nearby field and watch over them so the wolf packs on Lion Mountain wouldn't bother them. They would be intimidated by the presence of human at the edge of the woods. So she sat there, and I imagine her to look like a little bit like little Bo Peep of fairy tale fame, if you will, you know, with her long dress and her shepherdess's bonnet and her shepherdess's crook and so on. And so she would sit there at the edge of the field and watch over her sheep every day, walk the sheep, and then bring them in back to the sheep pen after they'd been out there a while. But one day, she went to her parents. Lily Mae went to her parents and said that she was a little bit alarmed because for several days there had been a looked like an old hermit sitting on the edge of the field, at the edge of the woods, bordering the field where the sheep were pastured. He would just sit there and look at her. And she said he never bothered her, but he was a typical-looking hermit with long beard, long scruffy hair, dirty, tattered clothes. But she said she felt more comfortable with him sitting there because it seemed like he was watching over her. Her parents said, well, you know, today they'd probably freak out, but the story is that they told her, well, you know, it's probably just that old hermit that lives in a cave up on Lion Mountain and not to worry about it, just mm-hmm. ignore him. So she did so, but it went pretty well, and nothing happened, but nothing untoward happened. But anyway, one of the things that neighbors noticed when they found out about this old hermit watching over Lily Mae Paul, one of the things they noticed was that the packs of wolves on Lion Mountain would come down into the valley every night, raid their sheep pens and their chicken coops and so forth. And it was a real nuisance. But they noticed that these packs of wolves never once bothered the sheep pen that Lily Mae Paul. And obviously there had to be a logical reason for that, but back in that day, clearer heads did not prevail. Superstitions often prevailed, and particularly those brought over from the old country. And some of those superstitions involved werewolves. In fact, in my story of the Lion Mountain Werewolf in my Volume 7, I explain about some of the stories that might have inspired this story of the Werewolf of Lion Mountain. But the prevailing opinion after the old-timers got together and started to discuss why the wolves were not bothering the sheep of Lily Mae Paul, consensus was that this old hermit had become so enamored with Lily Mae Paul that he would go up to the mountains at night and he would transmogrify in the light of a full moon into a werewolf. And he would become the alpha male of the packs of wolves on Lion Mountain, bring them down into the valley at night, and there they would get their sustenance by raiding sheep pens and chicken coops and so forth. But he would steer them away from Lily Mae Paul sheep because he liked her so much. And so, anyway, one night, one old hunter had grown tired of hearing the wolves howl up in Lion Mountain every night because he knew that meant they'd be coming down to raid the sheep pens and so forth. I should say one morning. And so he took his trusty musket and went out to a field at the foot of Lion Mountain and waited for the wolves, hoping he'd see one. And sure enough, it got to be mid-afternoon before anything happened, but sure enough, he saw what it looked to be a dark shape slinking across a field next to Lion Mountain. And it looked like it was slinking low, like it didn't want to be seen. And right away, he thought, you know, that's the way wolves behave. I'm just going to fire and kill this doggone thing. Because he knew that payment for bounties on wolf hides was pretty high. So this was something, I think, that inspired him in the first place to go out there looking for wolf kills. So he fired his musket, and he heard a whelp of pain, and he saw the wolf kind of limping off and darting into the woods, dark woods, beside the field. Mm-hmm. Well, he noticed that it was starting to get dark. And he figured in the dark, he couldn't follow a blood trail anyway. So he thought maybe he'd postpone it till next morning. And also I thought maybe the tail of the werewolf might have emerged from his consciousness too. And he didn't feel like maybe it would be a good idea to go into the dark woods with a werewolf prowling around in there as well.
Yeah, anyway, that's probably a bad idea.
I would agree.
Not the best idea. But anyway, he actually hung it up that night and came back the next morning. And sure enough, he saw a blood trail in the middle of the field, and he followed it into the woods, got into the woods a short distance, and there he saw a dark shape lying in the woods. And he walked up to it, and much to his horror, it was not the carcass of a wolf, it was the carcass of the old hermit. And the more lurid accounts of the tale that turned this into a werewolf tale, say that when the hunter rolled the corpse over so they could look at the face was covered with hair. The palms of his hands were covered with hair. Arms were covered with hair. And his eye teeth were protruding out over his lower lip, just like pictures of a werewolf you might see.
Yeah.
So those were lurid accounts of the tale. But anyway, I actually found a descendant of the Paul family. He was very kind to escort me around the mountain and show me some of the significant places involved in the tale. He actually took me to what is now still a working farm and was the original Paul farm there in the Schwalben Creek Valley. It's at the corner of State Road and Schwalben Creek Road. So it's a working farm. And if you look in the fields behind there, I've got a good picture of that. And I envisioned that maybe it was the field where William the Eighth Paul actually pastured her sheep. And anyway, the interesting part of it is that Parson Snyder said that when they discovered that the hermit had been shot and killed, they decided to give him a decent burial and write it off as a hunting accident. Because back in those days, this was the edge of the wilderness, you know. It was very remote. There was no local law, and nearest law was miles and miles away. So they just decided to write it off as a hunting accident and bury the old hermit in the edge of the corner of the field where he was shot. So Parson Snyder said, I went to that spot, and there's no evidence of that today. In fact, I even talked to one of the people whose houses overlooks the field and asked them about it, and they said, well, it hasn't been there in our day, and they never saw it. The 96-year-old Parson Snyder said that when he was just a young boy, 6 years old, that marker was still there at the edge of the field. What they had done, they'd taken a wooden post, pounded it into the ground, and nailed onto that a rectangular sign on which they had carved an epitaph. And the epitaph was, and this is Pennsylvania Dutch, as I say, they were German. Epitaph was B, spelled D-I-E, and Wolf, spelled W-O-L-F-F, Mons, M-A-N-N, apostrophe S, then Grob, G-R-O-B. You transfer that into English, it translates to the Wolf Man's Grave.
Wow, very interesting.
You might, I mean, I've been to that spot, and there's no evidence of it today, but Parson Snyder told me there are, I want to just tell you, there are some current evidences to them that somewhat support the legend. Parson Snyder said he heard this story from his grandfather. His name was Aaron Snyder. And Aaron Snyder said that he knew Lily Mae Paul by sight. And he would often see her driving a team of horses, pulling a wagon filled with wool to the old woolen mill in nearby Clingerstown. And believe it or not, that old woolen mill still stands there today. I've been there and taken pictures of it. It's not a woolen mill anymore. It's just a storage barn, pretty much. And anyway, the gentleman that took me to the Paul farm and showed me around there said that he couldn't believe that people back in that time believed in werewolves. And I said, well, I kind of beg to differ with you because of the way that superstition has colored people's minds, how deeply embedded and entrenched they were in people's minds before science and education obliterated them. But I think probably they remembered the old werewolf tales from Europe, and that colored their opinions.
Yeah, that's very possible. Yeah, but it definitely is an interesting story. I never heard from this area.
They say, too, that... it's still sometimes whispered in hushed tones in the nearby villages of Reebok and Lechkill, right there in the area. You might have heard of those towns. Maybe you might know where they are.
So you said that this grave was supposedly on Schwalben Creek Road?
It's on the corner of Covered Bridge and Schwalben Creek Valley Road.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yep, it's just a field there today, a bare field. And you won't see any depression, you won't see any posts or anything like that today. But Parson Snyder pointed at that spot as being the place where he saw the post with the epitaph on it.
And I think that was also one of the pictures you sent to us, right?
I think it was.
Okay, yeah, I believe it was.
Yep. I mean, if he said that he saw it, you can't really, you know, tell him he didn't see that. That's pretty interesting.
It really is.
That's as close to a firsthand account of, like, you know, having seen the werewolf or having seen, you know, any of these things going on, that's as close as you can get.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And again, you know, when I give my lectures and talks and so forth, I give lectures to different groups and so on. People often ask me, "Do you believe in ghosts?" And I tell them, I say, "Look, I said I'm not out to convince anybody. There are such things. I was trained as a scientist to think critically, logically, and I go by the premise that extraordinary beliefs require extraordinary proofs. So that's the approach I take to these ghost stories. But more about that later. Anyway, next ghost story is also one of the more interesting tales I've collected, I think. People want to hear the ghost stories this time of year, so I don't want to disappoint. So this one comes...
Yep, sure, this is a perfect time of year.
This one is one of the most interesting ghost tales I've come across in all my years I've collected tales. And it comes from a place called the White Deer Valley of Union and Center Counties. And in my That's My Fireside Ghost Tales book, I titled that chapter Moonlight and Deathly Shadows. And it's a tale on my talks that I also like to call The Luminescent Ghost, the White Deer Valley. And let me just give you a little background on the White Deer Valley. It was named for an albino deer that was shot back there at the time the first settlers moved into the area. And nobody had ever seen an albino deer before, and it caused such a sensation that they named the valley and the little creek that runs through it the White Deer Valley and the White Deer Creek. It's said that no albino deer has been shot in that valley since, but there's another white presence that makes its home in this valley, if we're to believe the old tales, that still cling to the valley. And one that I'd like to cite first was written by an early collector of the region's legends, and one he titled The Ghost Walk. And I want to share that with you now. I want to share with you what he wrote, because sure. It's an interesting account, and it kind of ties in to the rest of the story. You remember the radio show hosted by the gentleman used to end it with, and now you know the rest of the story. I forget his name anymore. But anyway, this will be one of those kinds of stories. But here's the story that this gentleman titled The Ghost Walk. And it was published in 1911. I'll read parts of it to you. It's not the whole thing, but it goes like this. In a dilapidated log farmhouse in the White Deer Valley resides an aged hermit. A kindly old man is Daniel McKean, but his mind, long focused on a single thought, has made him an uninteresting companion to others. In his younger days, he had helped his father build the log house in which he lives, and also the log barn out back, behind which stood two gigantic white pines. One night, after rounding up and putting their sheep into the sheep pen, he bedded down his horse and walked out into the dark night. It was then that he noticed a peculiar ball of white light dancing in midair between the two white pines. The ball elongated until it assumed the form of a young girl of supernatural beauty. Then it descended and slowly walked to one tree, touched it with one hand, and in a moment more resumed the shape of a ball of white light and disappeared. Every night thereafter, young Daniel watched the spot, hoping to see the woman again. But when his daytime work began to suffer, he confessed as to why his father cut down both pine trees. Undeterred, the moonstruck young man, night after night, watched the tree stumps, and at the present time, he waits and hopes for the return of his spectral sweetheart. That's a romantic tale, but the gentleman who wrote that story is known to have invented and embellished his stories quite a bit. But before dismissing him entirely, in this case, I think you should hear the story of two Lock Haven University students whose encounter would be with what might be the same spirit, might make you change your mind about the authenticity of the story I just read you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They were Lock Haven University students from New Jersey, and their exams were over at the end of the semester, and they were heading down Route 80 to eventually get to Route 15 to get on the turnpike to go home to New Jersey. And that particular night, they got to a point in Route 80 where it was a parking lot. Apparently, there had been an accident ahead, and traffic was just totally stopped. It wasn't going anywhere. And they knew there was a shortcut at the Mile Run exit. They could go through the White Deer Valley and pick up Route 15, eventually down there. So they headed down. They managed to get off Route 80 and onto the Mile Run exit. And they headed down the White Deer Valley. And darkness had fallen. They turned on their headlights. And they were I was surprised by a luminescent light on the roadside ahead. And when they passed by, there were the first two dumbstruck to stop. And eventually they collected their senses, and the boy turned to his girlfriend and he said, "Did you see what I just saw?" And she described it, and they both agreed what they had seen. And what they thought they had seen was that it looked like a young girl in distress in that illuminated area. So they turned the car around and drove back, and sure enough, they could see that there was still a luminescence there. And as they got closer and their headlights became focused on that luminescent spot, they said that it became clearer. This image became more and more clear, and it turned into an image of a beautiful young woman. And they said that she was dressed in a beautiful white dress, but it was totally transparent. The young man said you could see everything. And anyway, they also noticed that it was so long that it went down to her feet, but they noticed that it seemed to be blowing in a night wind around her legs and so forth. But they said there was no night wind blowing that night. And they said they stood there transfixed looking at this beautiful image. She was just beautiful. And they said that the thing they remembered most about her later was the sadness in her eyes. She just seemed to be so despondent about something. They said they sat there and looked at her and looked at her, and suddenly, they said, she turned into a ball of light and shot off into the woods.
That's definitely an interesting story. I find it more interesting that you found the backstory too, that older story, the new recent one up that the students seen.
Yeah, I was pleased about that, and kind of lends some credence to the old story as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually really funny too, because I've driven past the Mile Run exit plenty of times. I've never gotten off at the Mile Run exit. However, there's nothing around there at all. And it always struck me how on the Mile Run exit, it actually says no services.
Yeah,
so I always wondered, what is down that way? But I've never had the time to go and explore it down there.
If you turn off the Mile Run exit, you'll come to an intersection, a perpendicular intersection. Go off to the right, that takes you back into Lock Cave, and it's rugged, it's isolated, it's bumpy. You go the other way, you hit some more signs of civilization, more houses and so forth, and eventually takes you down to Route 15. But if you turn left and follow that road down, you come to a bridge across the creek, and it was shortly after you crossed that bridge on the right where this luminescent ghost supposedly appeared. I had ghost hunting friends who wanted to go to the spots I've written about and do their ghost hunting. And I agreed because they're very, very scientific about it. They're not the kind that accept anything at face value. They like to debunk and debunk and debunk.
Right.
Supposedly in the spring of the year after the last spring break in Lock Haven University, we went down there, sat until it got dark, till it got dark. And of course, didn't see anything, but it was kind of fun just to be there and get a sense of the atmosphere of the place, which is nice to do when you're writing about a place.
Did any of your friends pick up on any, supernatural or spiritual things that were going on there? Did they get anything from that area that was ghostly?
They did not, and sometimes they can, especially the wife of the man I went with. So no, they did not, and they mentioned that no, they did not see anything that night.
That's still interesting, though.
Definitely interesting.
That you found the old story, and then there was a newer sort of follow-up story with the students from Lock Haven. And like you said, even though they might not have picked up on anything then, but that doesn't cancel out the possibility that there could be, that there could have been a ghost or something there, because your ghost hunter friends couldn't, pick up on anything that night that they went there.
Exactly. It's just a matter of when they decide to materialize, I guess. It's funny, I gave a ghost tour one time in a place, and a little girl asked, "Are we going to see ghosts?" And I said to her, some people see them, some don't. You just have to keep your eyes open and hope you do.
It's definitely something you can't guarantee.
That's right. That's perfectly true.
They only come around when they want to be seen
yep.
or heard.
That's right. So anyway, I don't know how long you want me to talk here. I haven't completed track of time, so you let me know when you want me to stop. But
I think we have enough time for one or two more stories if you have them.
I do. This one, this is closer, even closer to your home listening area. This one is from a place called World's End State Park. It's in the Endless Mountains of Sullivan County. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
How it's in God's name is a matter of conjecture, but no doubt the early settlers probably dubbed that because it was so remote and impassable when they first encountered it. But since then, its natural beauty has just attracted visitors by the thousands. And they've enjoyed treks through the Canyon Vista Trail, hikes up to the haystacks and the rock garden boulders. And also they might head south to the lake at nearby Eagles Mere. There they might encounter the ghost that's said to haunt the waters of the lake. It's a tale in my Fascinating Fireside Ghost Tales book I titled Misty Moonbeams and Foggy Nights. And today I'll refer to it as the Loved Lock Ghost at Lewis's Lake. You see, Eagles Mirror Lake was not known by that name originally. It was called Lewis's Lake. It stood beside, the name came from George Lewis. He owned the glassworks that stood beside the lake in the early 1800s. He built the, it was a man-made lake. And the story of the lake's ghost would have been forgotten except for a diary kept by a man named William Herndon. He was the bookkeeper for George Lewis, the guy who owned the glassworks. And in that diary, there's an entry for August 1809, and it describes an outing that William Herndon took to the lake with Mrs. Lewis, the wife of George Lewis, her sister, and Herndon's wife, Clara. And Herndon had married Clara just 2 months previous. And they met her peerless, ne'er-do-well brother-in-law at the lake, and he had improvised a sailboat from one of the boats that had been left there in the lake. And he convinced Mrs. Lewis and her sister and Clara to go out in the lake in the boat. Herndon abstained. He didn't want any part of it. When they were out in the middle of the lake, freak winds came up and an unexpected storm, and the boat capsized. And they were all, the occupants of the boat were all floundering in the water. They were all dressed in their clothes, not any swimming gear or anything, so they were having trouble staying afloat. Herndon managed to save every one of them except his beloved Clara. She sank into the waters of the lake, and she never resurfaced. So after that, Herndon was so despondent, so sad about the death of his wife, that he said that every night he went to the same flat rock at the edge of the lake near the spot where his wife drowned and sat there just bemoaning her loss. And he claimed that after several months of sitting on the rock every night, he claimed that when the mist formed over the lake at that very spot, he could see the image of his wife gliding through them over the water. This became too much for him to bear eventually, and he became so despondent, so suicidal, that he said he threw himself into the waters of the lake just so he could be with his wife once more. And today that rock is known as Lover's Rock. And it's still there today. It can be seen. I think I sent a picture of that as well, Dan.
Yeah, I believe anyway, I did get a picture of that.
And you can walk up to that rock, but I would have to say that the trek up to that rock is not for the faint of heart, because what you got to do, you walk through it, an overgrown tunnel of rhododendron bushes. It's a very dark tunnel. It's not a very inviting place. And the whole thing just adds a mysterious and forbidding atmosphere to the place, to this emotionally charged spot, if you will. And so that's supposedly the story of the lovers of Love Rock right there in Little Tennessee State Park. And I've got some other stories as well, but I think you said that that's about all the time you had for this time, but I do have others I can share another time if you're interested.
Sure. We'll love to have you back on the show. It seems like you do have some very interesting stories all across our viewing area.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. You really gave us a lot. I mean, between ghost stories and werewolves and, you know, you kind of gave us a little bit of everything there.
I tell you what, I'd like to leave you with one thought. You know, as I say in my lectures, people ask me if I believe in ghosts and so forth. But I leave them with this thought. There was a paragraph in an early book written by a collector of old-time ghost stories and, so forth. This was published back in the 1950s, and this gentleman wrote the following. He said, "Despite our advances in science and technology, the ghost still promenades at night and laughs at our electricity." And I think that's still true today.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially with all the technology and improvements that they keep having, there's still those stories that keeps everyone guessing at what that could have been.
It's a phenomenon that has persisted for centuries. And so, yeah, people ask me if I believe in ghosts, and I tell them, you know, that I've collected these stories, and I'm not about to convince them one way or another whether they are of supernatural origin, but I tell them that people have told me these stories, in all seriousness, and that these people are not drug addicts, not alcoholics. They'd serve not inveterate liars. They would serve as reliable witnesses in courts of law. No reason to lie to me. And sure, they've seen things that we would define as ghosts, and they can't explain them any other way. So I say that my final conclusion is that I believe the phenomenon is real. I'm not prepared to say it's anything supernatural. It might just be part of nature we don't understand yet, but there's no doubt in my mind that there's a real phenomenon there.
There's always been a theme. I mean, you know, as long as you can think back throughout history, there's always been a theme of these, you know, happenings that people can't explain. And over time, yeah, some of them we have been able to explain and figure out exactly what it was and kind of debunk some of these things. But even today, there's still so many things that people are experiencing or seeing that they have no explanations for. So maybe eventually we'll be able to explain them, but who knows?
Yeah, that's very true. And that's why I keep an open mind on the subject. You know, a lot of old folks didn't want to talk about ghost tales. They were feared they'd be ridiculed, you know. But after I gained confidences and so forth and didn't try to ridicule what they were telling me, I got these interesting stories, and you can still get them today.
Yep, that's the same thing we do on the show. We ask people to share their stories with us. We don't ridicule anybody for them, and just see their own personal experiences. There's no doubt in my mind that they're seeing something happen. We just don't know what.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I have never personally seen a ghost, but I still keep an open mind.
Right. Now, before you leave us this evening, if anyone was interested in picking up a copy of one of your books, where would they find it at?
Well, I have a website. It's called www.pafiresidetales.com. That's www.pafiresidetales.com. And also, for more pictures of some of these stories, I have a Facebook page of the same name. It's Pennsylvania Fireside Tales. It's my website, or my Facebook page.
Oh, perfect. We'll be sure to tag you and also share your link for your website in our post about this podcast. So some of our listeners can check out your Facebook page as well as your website so that they can hopefully purchase some books and, you know, get more info if they're looking for it.
I've enjoyed talking to you again.
We enjoyed talking with you also.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your stories.
My pleasure.
We'll love to have you back sometime.
Okay, let me know.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on The Creepy Side of NEPA tonight. I'd like to just remind you of a few things before we leave. First, like us. Follow The Creepy Side of NEPA, depending on the podcast platform that you listen to us on.
And don't forget to like our Facebook page, which is WNEP's The Creepy Side of NEPA. There you can find links for all of our episodes. And we have been sharing a couple of different things throughout the month of October, including some video vaults of stories that NewsWatch 16 has covered that involve some creepy stories on The Creepy Side of NEPA.
Until next week, enjoy The Creepy Side of NEPA.
This has been The Creepy Side of NEPA. If you have a spooky story that took place in northeastern or central Pennsylvania, send it to ghost@wnep.com for your chance to share it on an upcoming episode. We're dying to hear from you.